This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And as you know, because I say it all the time, writing a letter to somebody, just saying what you remember, what you feel, what you appreciate, and stamping it and mailing it really makes a difference in a day, if not in a life. Today's guest is Hank Berman. And, you know, I didn't even ask you how you'd like to be introduced. Come tell us what you do. You're a psychologist, right?
No, I'm a marriage, family, and child therapist.
Okay.
It's called MFT, marriage, family, therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a private practice here in San Francisco and see all kinds of folks for all kinds of presenting problems, depression, mm-hmm. anxiety, and marital problems, drug addiction, alcohol addiction.
So across the board. Yes, I
mm-hmm.
see. Okay. How is that different from a psychologist?
Psychologists will do more of the testing.
Psychological testing. Okay, I never even thought
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay,
we're
thank
in the
you.
Trenches.
Yes, I thought. Okay, thank
yeah.
you. I had heard about you from a friend,
mm-hmm.
and she had mentioned to me that you were raised by two deaf parents.
Correct.
And I was so interested in that. It happens that I know a handful of deaf people who have children, and the whole business of learning to speak. And will you just talk about?
Sure.
Your
you know,
life?
It's interesting because
people, are you an only child?
I am an only
uh-huh.
child. People will assume that it's radically different than other families, and it's not the case. I mean, the primary difference was that my parents communicated in American Sign Language.
So you naturally grew up learning two languages?
Three.
Okay.
We lived for a short period of time, my grandparents, they spoke only Yiddish.
Uh-huh.
So every time they didn't want me to understand, of course, you know that story, they would start talking Yiddish, shah de kinder, and my ears would perk up. But my primary language was sign language. That
mm-hmm.
was the first one, because you can move your hands to make certain movements before you can vocalize.
Is that easier to learn sign language than
it's the same thing. You know,
uh-huh.
As you're exposed, how did you learn to speak English? You just mimicked automatically. It wasn't learning like in class kind of learning.
Right.
So, no, it's not very difficult. It's a language that comes naturally if you
no,
parents
no,
speak it.
I didn't mean is it difficult. Is it? Well, yes, I guess I said is it easier because mm-hmm. you were moving your hand. You
yeah.
looked like you were going to say that we naturally move our hands.
Right, babies do.
And
so my first sign was milk. I'd squeeze my right hand and my mom would bring milk. And,
uh-huh.
and so... You know, those are the touchstones of,
sure.
of that kind of interactive learning that babies do.
What's different when you aren't hearing spoken language at home?
Really, not very much. I lived in a tenement building in New York City.
Oh, so you heard a lot of people.
All over the place.
Uh-huh.
But the interaction is the same, except, for example, when I'd stop my foot, which is acceptable in deaf culture, and it seems rude among hearing people if you stomp your foot and wave your hand to get someone's attention.
Oh, well,
so that was something that would occur in my household. It was, you know,
sure.
acceptable.
Of course, you have to get somebody to turn around and look at you.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And she'd pick up the vibrations
yeah.
on the floor and turn around
oh.
and look. And then I could ask for what I needed or...
Yeah. And when did you start speaking vocally?
Probably at 2 years old.
Because of all the neighbors?
Yeah.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then there was not so much difference.
Not so much
at
difference.
All.
The difference these days is in the technology of liberation and emancipation for deaf people.
What
so
is that?
Typically, my mom, when I was 13, Jewish kids become a man, they get, boys do, and for women, it's mm-hmm. women, bat mitzvah, and I asked for a telephone to be like the other kids in my neighborhood. So she got me a phone, and 2 weeks later I said, I don't want the phone anymore, because she was asking me as...
Oh,
she
would use it for you?
Yeah, to like, would you call Mrs. Shapiro
uh-huh,
in Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
ask her son to ask her mother... his mother, if I could come visit on Tuesday.
So you wanted a phone, not a job as a secretary.
Or interpreter, right.
right.
And however, you know, then with the advent now of what we have today is relay services.
Yes.
A deaf adult, or deaf youngster for that matter, can call a doctor, make their own appointment, call Mrs. Shapiro themselves directly. And we have a relay service. So you and I pay, I think, maybe a nickel a month extra on our phone bill.
Uh-huh.
And a deaf person can call into this bank, phone bank, sign, and that person, the hearing person,
operates.
Oh, because
there's a visual component to
right,
it.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. And they will call the physician or the friend or whoever else. Or
that's
there's
great.
Direct service through this video phone services that are that popped up all over the country, so deaf people can hang out and talk to each other the way you and I do, except visually.
Okay, so that part's great, but has it had any impact on deaf culture as a whole?
Of course it has.
Like what?
Well, the idea, as I said, of emancipation. You know,
because
there was
it's no longer such an insular special community in a way.
It's still very insular, and uh-huh. the language keeps it that way.
Uh-huh.
And you know, deaf people tend to marry deaf people, profoundly deaf people, 95-96%. And when they do marry hearing people, it's oftentimes an interpreter or somebody who signs fluently. And the adaptation in those families and those couples is that the hearing person has to move more towards deaf culture.
Sure.
We can learn sign language. A deaf person doesn't
right.
learn to talk intelligibly
right.
so readily.
Yes.
You know.
Also, sign language is so nice to look at. It's
a beautiful
so
language.
Sometimes
and
I
rich.
See, yes, in a restaurant, yeah. I'll see yeah. two people signing, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makes you jealous a little bit, huh?
Well, I'm going to, yes, I told you. We start off by my saying I want to learn it, and I have wanted to for a long time. I grew up with some very close friends. Actually, they weren't film interpreters. They dubbed mm-hmm. movies, an older couple, and mm-hmm. they spoke, I think, 11 or 12 languages
mm-hmm. wow.
fluently.
Wow.
And one of them was American Sign.
Beautiful.
And when we would be there for dinner, if they would have a disagreement at the table, they would just be and everybody wanted to learn
right.
it. It was
right.
great.
Right.
And we should. I told you before, I think our schools make a big mistake.
I think it would be great if it was woven into the elementary school experience
sure.
for kids.
Yeah. As a language, as a necessary language.
It was also good to know when I traveled around the world. In Afghanistan or Pakistan, in areas where nobody spoke English and I needed a place. They're home signs. They're universal. Not American Sign Language. It's not universal. It's an American sign. There's British Sign Language. There's French Sign Language. They're very different.
Significantly different.
Very
though.
Different, yeah. There are certain things that are very common. But in Afghanistan, if I'd arrive in a town or a city and I want a place to sleep, I would, you know, make the sign for sleep,
right.
make the sign for eat, and right. I'd point and say,
well,
where?
We all do that.
Right.
Yeah,
except it became a little bit easier for me, you know.
Because it was natural to you to do it?
Yeah, exactly.
See, I do it when we're traveling. We were in China, and I just
lived. Are you Italian?
Yes. Right. And it was very easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... You say it's easier for you to do that because you're used to using your hands
mm-hmm.
and your body is to... But when nobody can understand you, when you need something...
You better.
You find out how easy it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And pleasant.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the combination of hand gestures and facial expressions, which
yes.
Kind of delineate the terminology, you know.
Although facial expressions, mm-hmm. those change from culture to culture.
They
do. And what's acceptable here can be such an insult somewhere else.
That's true.
You know?
That's true.
So you mentioned that... Stamping your foot and waving your hand.
They were acceptable modes of getting someone's attention in my household, whereas in a hearing household, that would be considered rude.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
So these are elements of deaf culture that I grew up with.
Did you grow up knowing, well, you must have known, or maybe you didn't, I shouldn't assume anything, mm-hmm. that there was a difference between your home or you and the other kids? Did
oh,
you
of course.
Feel-
right away in New York City, I mean, kids can be kind of cruel.
Right.
6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So there were not a lot of deaf models. There was no Sesame Street at that time. So there was a lot of ignorance about deafness and its normality. So a lot of the kids make fun of my parents.
Oh,
moving
my goodness.
Their hands and stuff
oh.
like that and making sounds that would mimic my parents' voice and so forth. So
what'd you do with that?
Fought.
Oh, good for you. Yeah.
And, you know, and then, of course, there's the other aspect, which is that it can be shaming and when you're a little kid. So
to be different.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so there were times when I didn't fight, and those are the times that I regret the most. Actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I didn't stand up for my parents. I didn't stand up for who they were and who I was.
Because that was what fighting was
right.
at that age, to
right.
stand up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, that is. Now, when did you learn... I shouldn't assume that either. When did you learn at some point that was a privilege, the way you grew up? And
absolutely.
That you got something extra?
Around 17, 18, when the era of psychedelics hit,
mm-hmm.
And I was part of those psychedelic pioneers back in the mid-60s. And
you say you were?
I was.
Oh, can we hear about that in a minute?
Certainly,
okay.
Sure. And, you know, then you have certain... accelerated and more acute realizations about your place in the universe.
Oh.
And so I began to have a switch from being feeling some shame and some reticence about involving, you know, my first girlfriend. I didn't want to invite her to the house. I did eventually, and she got along fine with my parents. But the residue of shame went to pride and a profound sense of pride, which I've carried ever
now
since.
Now, what do you mean the residue of shame went to pride?
Well, through some early experiences when I was 17, 18
years old.
You shifted
it?
It shifted, and I began to see my parents very differently and see their struggle in a very positive light. Mm-hmm. You take things for granted when you're a kid, my parents functioned very well. My dad had a job.
What did he do?
He made women's pocketbooks.
Oh.
At a time when there was less automation, right? Yeah.
That and shoes. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, I became...
And your mother was at home?
Yes, mm-hmm. She was. I was very close to them throughout my life, even when I moved to California. And my mom did not learn how to type, so that we didn't communicate too much on the phone, because I moved out to California, they invented this thing called a TDD, teletypewriter device. And we got one for my mom.
I thought that was how you spoke on the phone. That's a different thing.
No, that's how we spoke on the phone before the video conferencing technology, where you can speak person to person. And she didn't have a computer. So, but I'd go to New York frequently and see them and enjoy the visits. I taught my kids some basic sign, so they were able to communicate a little bit, and that made my parents very happy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And were they comfortable in their life?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. They had, okay.
As a matter of fact, the interesting thing about that people wouldn't pick up, it's a sort of a nuance of deaf life, deaf culture, is my mom and dad had friends for 50, 60 years. They met at the school for the deaf, right?
Where was that? In New York.
In New York City. It was called the Lexington School for the Deaf. Mm-hmm. It moved to Long Island, I believe. But it was on Lexington Avenue. And they made friends there as kids that they kept throughout their lives. And not many of us can say that. I'm fortunate. I've got friends from when I was 16, 15 years old that are still friends with. But not a lot of people do that. And then towards the end of their lives, when they retired, my dad retired, they moved to a building in the Lower East Side that was primarily deaf. So a lot of their friends that they knew as kids were living in that building.
Nice.
That was really nice.
Yes, yes. And you talked about, just to shift, because mm-hmm. I was so interested in
sure.
this. You said you worked with Coco. Will you tell about that?
Yeah,
you
that's
said
one
briefly,
of the things that...
How did you come to do that?
That's one of the things that was a benefit. A very close friend of mine, Tony, he was working out at the San Francisco Zoo. And he introduced me to a woman named Penny Patterson. She was conducting her research for a PhD at Stanford on a baby gorilla to see how much sign language that gorilla could learn. And she didn't know sign language, so she hired me. It was a lot of fun. It was a wonderful experience.
How'd you and Coco get along?
Well, she was a baby.
Yeah. So you didn't stay with her for long?
Not very long.
Uh-huh.
But it was a lot of fun. The idea of carrying around a baby gorilla. I remember a friend came out from Colorado, from Boulder, with his son who was 3 years old. Yeah, and I said, well, let me get my daughter, and I went and got Coco. And it was a lot. It was just a very enriching experience for me.
It sounds like a wonderful thing. So, mm-hmm. in short, your life was really not any different from...
Not profoundly.
I mean, because it's the same difference as... A lot of immigrant children feel when their parents don't speak English.
Precisely.
And I always wondered about that because, they try to, they don't like their accents, which I always think are gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Accents are important.
I think so,
too. The
way
we speak, it lets you know something about somebody.
When you're a kid, you have a different worldview.
Why is that?
Different, I don't know. It's something about developmental part of your life when you're younger, where your differences are... you want to blend in. Your
Does that have to do with feeling
formed.
Safe?
I think it has to do with feeling part of.
Uh-huh. And that has to do with feeling safe?
Absolutely.
There's
got to
be something, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't
it? Well, we're affiliative beings.
Yeah.
That's what we seek to do. Friendships, family, and so forth. So we want to be like everybody else. We look around, we see what people are doing, and that's how kids try on various things.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be the same as everybody else.
I mean, I think our institutions really miss some opportunities. I went to junior high school, and there were a lot of Spanish-speaking family kids mm-hmm. from Spanish-speaking families. And most of them were from Mexico. And I don't know why the school didn't have, like, after-school clubs so that non-Spanish-speaking kids could learn Spanish and
it
kids
was the zeitgeist. It was what was happening back then. Nowadays,
those guys
hopefully,
were so cute. It would have been nice to be. I'm telling you.
Nowadays, I would hope that there is a greater appreciation of the value of knowing the other and becoming
yeah.
familiar
oh,
with
I
the
think,
other.
Yeah.
Just to reduce the conflict and violence that accrues. I mean,
and to get a little lessons in there. I mean, now we've got to go pay for Spanish lessons.
Well, it's not. Know. Yeah, it's also the less the human lesson,
right? Of course,
of common
course.
Humanity,
yes.
And that the other there's a resource in the other for us rather than a threat in the other to us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is what else in your life has been significant?
Wow, that?
You said you had a few people you could write love letters to. I was curious about them.
Well, I think before. Then, before I had a family, I forged a family from the friends, from the mulch of friendships that
sure.
occurred during the anti-war movement.
Yes.
Like I
oh.
said, the
and where were you then?
In New York City.
Ah. And
we were active. We'd go to all the demonstrations, the Pentagon, Chicago, mm-hmm. Bonded around that and around
sure.
psychedelics, to be honest.
Now, can you talk about that for a minute, the psychedelics?
Sure.
Because you indicated that you had some...
Well, I mean, it was a time in which... if
leadership.
No, I wouldn't say leadership.
Followship.
Okay. More likely.
Okay.
We were very fortunate. We got to some interaction with Timothy Leary and Ralph Metzner and Richard Alpert. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
We went up to Millbrook to visit and became very interested in psychedelics, not to party and have fun, but rather as in the pursuit of enlightenment, in the pursuit of a spiritual pursuit, basically.
So you feel they had something definite to offer in that?
Oh, they certainly did.
Okay.
I mean, and there was a potential there as well to transform society. It fell short. There was a lot of co-optation. And we didn't realize what we were up against in a sense. And the idealism didn't bear fruit, really. And, for some people, it was not a good experience. It can be very frightening.
Yeah.
We formed a group that supported each other in that experience. We read from the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
I remember all
we
of that.
We guided
yeah.
each other and so forth.
Sure.
The insights and the expansion of the humanity and empathy for others, not just sympathy, but empathy, was profound and indelible. And I think it marked many of us throughout our lives and brought me, in some fashion, to the work I do, which is a psychotherapist.
And do you think more men benefit in that way for women, that empathy? And I'm asking that because I'm thinking that women are closer to that by nature. Somebody's going to skewer me for being sexist, huh?
No, I hope not. there's something archetypally true about that. No, women had profound experiences as well, but don't forget, it was still very much a male-oriented society. Mm. So men were the ones that stepped forward in the media and said, look at me, look at us.
Oh, yes, because at the be-ins, you would see the women too. Yes,
sure, they'd be dancing along
right.
with the rest of us.
Right. So who in did you write letters to your parents? I mean, obviously that
oh,
would be easier for them.
Before
the telephone magic.
Yeah. When I traveled, I went from New York to California the wrong way. I was like wrong way Corrigan of the Hitchhikers.
Would you?
Well, it wasn't really a mistake. That's a joke. But I went from east to west rather than go west. So I went around the world and I hitchhiked primarily. So every chance I got, I'd send off a letter to my folks telling them I was okay.
Oh, yes.
And something about the country that I was in, the place, my experiences, not everything, but I didn't want to worry them. And then when I got home, when I got
that
back
to New York.
That you
were still alive was good enough news.
That was good enough for them. And when I got home, I was able to, they saved the letters, of course.
Of course they did.
And I got to, thumb through them. And for many years, after that, every once in a while, I'd take a look.
Okay, so isn't that amazing to be able to look at yourself as you were?
Very, it's an incredible experience.
Are you the same person?
No, I hope not.
Right.
Yeah, yes. Constantly evolving. The standard commentary is that I hope I'll be evolving until I'm 95.
Sure.
Learning and changing and adapting.
And yes, they keep the letters. Mm-hmm. And did they write letters to their other friends who were deaf?
Sure. I think they did more.
Did they do that in Yiddish or in English?
No, in English. Uh-huh. My deaf parents did not know Yiddish. My grandparents did.
Oh, I see what you were saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't pick that up?
No.
So who would you write a love letter to now at this stage of your life?
That's,
do you still write love letters? I mean, I'm saying love letters.
Letters of appreciation, gratitude,
yes.
Expressions of how I feel about people.
Yes, anything, your truth put into paper in a loving and compassionate way.
Well, not as, you know, with emails,
right.
I succumb to
the
sin of convenience, which is, it has its drawbacks.
Well, it does have immediate, which is wonderful.
Yeah, so I do write emails, and I do try to live in gratitude and express gratitude whenever I can. And if being asked the question now, it's my children. I have two daughters that I adore, and they turned out to be just really good people.
Oh, nice.
They have a good sense of integrity and responsibility, compassion for others.
Do they have things in your handwriting?
I think they probably do.
Oh, good.
They probably do, because my youngest daughter lived in Ohio for many years, and Texas before that, and then finally she lived for a couple of years in France. She was working in outside of Paris, and she just got back a couple of months ago, got married, lives up in Northern California. My older daughter's an attorney, civil rights, chip off the old block, and I'm proud of them both.
The reason I ask is the older I get and the more I do of this, I have become so aware of what these letters can do when they're found after we're gone. Having something in your handwriting.
Well, I got to tell you, this conversation is going to spark me and, you know, move me in that direction for sure.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me a story like that. You know, so many people have one woman who needed her mother's chicken soup recipe, and she couldn't find it on the index card.
Uh-huh.
And she called her sister, and her sister said, well, that's okay, I can tell you. She said, no, it's in mommy's handwriting.
Sure.
And there's something about handwriting that is a reappearance of a whole person.
Well,
I'll
commit to pen and paper now.
Okay.
What I thought was, until this conversation, was not thinking about it, but was a substitute, was that saying I love you on a daily basis to both my children.
Well, that's wonderful.
Which I think I've done pretty much all their lives. And letting them know, of course, on their birthdays I write something.
Okay, that's good. Yes. Yeah.
Fairly poetic,
yes.
You know.
And you know, people have phone conversations, and I can't remember the name of the very smart woman who said, you can't reread a phone call.
True, very true.
And there's something about being able to reread when you're feeling low,
mm-hmm.
or you're feeling you miss somebody, that you can just bring out those letters and have them. And, you know, I say all the time, because I'm touched by it myself, that when somebody's reading a letter that you've written by hand, they're touching something that's felt the touch of your hand.
No question
about
it.
And it is so holding hands over time and space.
You know, now that I think about it, I'm going to ask, but I hope my daughters have saved all the birthday cards I sent them over the years, because
yes.
That certainly would add up to a pretty good gratitude list.
And I think people do save mm-hmm. cards. I think they save, if the cards say something,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm so glad you did this with me. Thank you.
And I can't leave out my wife, by the way, because
okay,
if she
good.
Listens to this.
You shouldn't leave out your wife.
No, I don't feel like I
right.
want to. She's another light in my life.
Oh, wonderful.
And is tremendously supportive of everything I do.
Nice.
And just a wonderful person. She's a piano teacher and an artist. Mm. And she brings culture to my life that
nice.
I otherwise overlook.
Now, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
You're talking about a letter to your wife.
Mm-hmm.
Would you hand it to her, or would you mail it to her?
Wow!
Yeah, that's.
I hadn't even thought of that.
So many big differences.
I think mailing it would really carry some weight.
Yes,
some gravitas.
Because it'll be a little nice surprise in that pile of otherwise junk
mm-hmm.
to see. But the other thing is, sometimes people leave a letter on a pillow, or mm-hmm. they hand it to, and then they stay in the room. Because reading a love letter is private.
Absolutely.
Reading any letter. You know, you see it in the movies sometimes. Somebody's gotten a letter and the other people in the room leave her with her letter.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
so private.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm so glad that you're enthusiastic about this.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, and I do look to a time when we're no longer here and what the effect of those letters is. You know, good paper and indelible ink. Still the most effective information storage system. Mm-hmm. I have letters that are 120 years old. They look like they've been written yesterday, and I can't play my VCRs of 15 years ago.
Wow. It's actually a book. My younger daughter's name is Milena, and there's a book called Brief auf Milena, Letters to Milena, by Franz Kafka.
Oh.
And it is a replication in print of the love letters between them both. And it's very beautiful.
I don't know that. I'll get that.
Yeah. Check it out.
It's also a, yes, it's also the truest form of history.
No question.
You know,
it's referenced a lot when in biographies or, as well as some autobiographies. So
the rest is guesswork.
Yeah. Treasure trove.
Yes. So, I mean, even if you were to write a letter and include something about Coco or include something about your LSD years, and somebody will find those in 80 years and, you know, have a fabulous PhD thesis on something. You know,
you
don't have to be grandiose. You know, there's a book of letters from the Middle Ages written, I forget what it is, but it's five women's stories. I can't remember the title of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just women who did laundry and cooked for their families, but they wrote down their thoughts and what was going on in their daily lives. And we have a total accurate portrayal of what life was like in 1520.
Wow.
It's amazing. You don't have to be grandiose. Everybody's grandiose. Thank you, dear, for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just want to remind you, before we say goodbye, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, first of all, writing a love letter is a special occasion. And if you just open your eyes and look around you, you will find somebody who would welcome a hello and I remember you fondly note from you. So until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye.